Sembla que pràcticament tots els integrants del seminari que havien d'arribar hi han arribat. Doncs, si els hi sembla, donarem inici a aquesta tercera sessió plenària de les 22enes jornades de la trobada de Barcelona, que sota el títol Desmuntant el negoci de la guerra, avui arriba a l'última sessió i en aquesta sessió que porta per títol Fent front al negoci de la guerra, campanyes internacionals, tinc aquí al meu costat a tres persones molt actives en les campanyes per desmuntar el negoci de la guerra. De fet, ells arriben ara de la penúltima, crec que és sessió del seminari que estan fent, força cansats perquè porten tot el dia discutint sobre les campanyes que fan, què més es pot fer, etc etc. Només dir-los, per exemple, que han parlat i han debatut sobre la privatització de la guerra, que també es va parlar una mica ahir al vespre aquí en aquesta taula. També han parlat sobre el moviment en contra del negoci de la guerra i la seva relació amb altres moviments socials, entre moltes altres coses. Per tant, no vull allargar-me més, els presentaré els tres ponents que parlaran avui. Després obrirem un torn de paraules perquè vostès puguin fer-los les preguntes que considerin oportunes i, finalment, els presidents de les dues organitzacions, de Justícia i Pau i la Fundació per la Pau, prendran el nostre lloc i faran la cloenda d'aquesta trobada de Barcelona. Bé, a la meva esquerra i al meu costat es troba un gran conegut de tots nosaltres, els que solen venir en aquests seminaris i trobades, que és en Colin Archer. Colin Archer, tot i ser escocès d'origen, em sembla que fa molts anys que no viu a la seva terra d'origen, sinó que està instal·lat a Suïssa com a secretari general de l'IPB. Ell no vol que li doni massa presentació, és molt conegut per tots nosaltres i ell el que té ganes és de parlar i explicar-los coses, per tant, no diré res més. Al seu costat es troba la senyora Wendila de Vries. Ella és holandesa, investigadora política que s'ha especialitzat en el comerç d'armes i la indústria militar. Es va llicenciar per la Universitat d'Amsterdam amb una tesi on comparava les diferents teories dels conflictes ètnics. I des del 1998 va fundar la campanya holandesa contra el comerç d'armes de la que actualment n'és la coordinadora. I finalment, al final de tot, tenim en Javier Garate, d'origen xilè, tot i residir a la capital britànica. Ell és membre fundador del col·lectiu Objecció de Consciència contra el Servei Militar, anomenat Ni Casco ni Uniforme, de Xile. Va formar part del primer grup d'objectors del seu país que va portar el cas fins a l'Acord Interamericana de Drets Humans. Des del 2005 coordina el programa de no violència de la World Resistance International, on va coordinar i editar el manual per a campanyes no violentes, traduït a més de 10 idiomes. Ha impartit tallers sobre diferents campanyes i accions no violentes arreu, a diferents països, i edita el butlletí electrònic Notícies de los especuladores de la guerra, enfocat a difondre les campanyes contra el negoci de la guerra. Ha organitzat diferents conferències, com ara la conferència internacional que va tenir lloc a Ahmedabad, a l'Índia, el 2010, sota el tema Vincles i estratègies, lluites no violentes i supervivència local versus militarisme global. Bé, doncs, com veuen, tres persones que ens podran aportar molt, espero, en aquesta taula. Sobretot, el que necessitem és enfortir els vincles i necessitem saber que es poden fer moltes coses per contrarrestar aquest poder i aquesta supremacia que tenen la despesa militar. Sense més dilació, dono la paraula a Colin. Please, can you like?
Bona tarda. You know, it's very good that sometimes you find that the intelligence services make mistakes. I was not born in Scotland, and I don't know who told you this false information. But that was my great-grandfather. But, you know, it's too long a story to go into now. I was born in London, and I just want to say that it was quite true what you said, that I love to come to Barcelona, and it's a great pleasure to be back here with so many old friends and new friends, and to be part of this important discussion about a very serious subject. When I came into the Plaza Catalunya on Friday, I was a bit surprised. It was the middle of the day, and there was no traffic. It was like empty. And I thought, what's happened? And then I saw it. There was a great crowd arriving with a big banner protesting against the cuts in training places and in the health service. And I thought, fantastic, the people are on the march. People here are not taking it lying down. They are fighting back. It was not a huge demonstration, but it was a lot of people, a lot of young people, professional people. And, you know, it's always encouraging in this age when everything is on a screen somewhere to see some real political action in the street. But then I thought how sad it is that it's necessary and what troubled times we are in now. Because from all that we read on these screens and in newspapers, an economic crisis has happened and maybe is about to happen again. We are on the edge of something. We don't know if we go over the edge or not. Let me read from the press of this week. Capitalist system is now near meltdown. You know, like a nuclear power plant. Near meltdown. This is a respectable newspaper. It's not some revolutionary rag. Here is the very respectable The Economist from London. And it says, hunting the rich. And the cartoon is of a hunt. Hunting for the foxes, you know, but the rich are being chased by the tax man. And this is a subject here in Spain too, I know. We're all thinking about ways to tax the rich more so we can save our precious capitalist system. Well, this is a new thing. You don't often see this on the front of The Economist. Well, they don't really agree with taxing the rich in the way that is proposed, but we won't go into detail. These are indicators of the new times we are in and the need for new thinking. In the case of taxing the rich, it's old thinking. I mean, Karl Marx had something to say about that a long time ago. But sometimes we have to recycle our ideas. But, you know, at the same time, there are taboo subjects, subjects that cannot be spoken about in certain forms of discourse. Take this one, for example. This is the World Development Report 2011 by the very respectable World Bank. You may have heard of them. Now, their special issue this year is conflict, security, and development. Hurrah, I think. Finally, they have noticed that there is a connection between conflict, security, and development. So I open the book hurriedly looking for some mention of the colossal sums of money being spent on armament and the way that that steals money from development. Not one word about this important dimension of the problem. They talk about corruption, they talk about the effects of violence on economies and destabilizing effects. But they don't talk about the big money. So it's our job. Well, first technical problem. I might need some help. Okay. We have invented a new word. It's called gadams. It's not a very beautiful word, but it spells in English Global Day of Action on Military Spending. This has been a project of my organization, the International Peace Bureau, together with an organization based in Washington, D.C., called the Institute for Policy Studies, which is one of the most well-established think tanks in Washington. Ah, yeah. Cinerama. Yeah, good, good. So, where to start? We began a new program in 2005 in the International Peace Bureau. We decided it was time to focus on a theme that seemed to be neglected by many movements, even by peace movements. And the theme we chose to name Disarmament for Development, to make the connection between these two important areas. Now, in the United Nations, there is a long history of resolutions and conferences relating disarmament and development. So it wasn't a new theme, but it was a theme that has been forgotten. Since 1987, there has not been a major conference on this topic. So we felt it was a good topic for IPB, since we have members in the North and the South and the East and the West, members who are very concerned with development as well as with disarmament. And we divide it into three parts. Number one, military spending, and the opposite, the theft of money from the social sector, from spending on social justice, the environment, poverty, and other issues. Number two, the impact of the weapons on development, on the poor communities, especially around the world, through landmines, through small arms, etc. And number three, the justifications and the doctrines that lie underneath this massive investment in a military system. So those are the three main topics. So tonight I'm just going to talk about number one, which, well, mainly a little bit on number three. And the action that we have focused on is just on this one day of action. But we do other things as well. I should mention that we are now starting an educational program, an online course around some of these themes, Disarmament for Development, which is a program together with the Universitat Oberta de Catalunya. So it's another reason to come to this city, which is always a pleasure. What are the purposes of the Global Day? Well, to make the issue visible, both locally, nationally, and I could add internationally also. Because our first problem was that while many, many people understand that there is a huge investment in the military, let's say, in war, there is an economy of war, there has been very little civil society campaign work. So we wanted to make that visible in the public and to inform the general public through our different actions. And one way, of course, is to get media coverage. And out of that comes a kind of community of people who sometimes work together, sometimes maybe have never met each other before, and who have the chance now to communicate internationally around these questions. So we've created a new global campaign. And in doing so, we've tried out things. We've experimented with different approaches. And you'll see some pictures of some of the things that people have done, including some people in this room. So the date we chose this year, the first year of this event, was the 12th of April, which was the day following the release of the annual data from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Every year they publish the new figures for military spending and also arms production, arms trade, and many other things. It's a, a very reliable source of information. So we wanted to, instead of have a helicopter in the picture in the newspaper or the TV about this information, we wanted to have a picture of our protests. It worked a little bit, but maybe not as well as we hoped. Next year, maybe we do better. So here you have the names of the two organizations. And we had, in the end, between 90 and 100 groups in about 37 countries, which is not bad for a first time around. But of course, we hope for many more actions next year, and not only on the Global Day. You don't change the world in one day. It has to be a continuous effort. So there is the website. I hope you can read it. Somehow it went very faint, but it's demilitarize.org. There is some information in Spanish and other languages on that site. And there are lots of photographs, lots of videos. There's a whole section of the reports of the work that people did all around the world in April. So it's some quite exciting stuff. Okay, you have heard a lot of statistics during these last days. You know, there is a famous quotation from Winston Churchill, which I quite like. He said, there are three levels. You start with lies, and then you have damned lies, and then you have statistics. You know, you can prove anything with statistics. So let's not be too obsessed. But I had to give you a few. So there are just four important statistics on this page. And I promise, no more numbers. So the first figure is the annual global military expenditure by governments. So this is our taxpayers' money. $1,630 billion, or if you prefer, $1.6 trillion US. Now that is the SIPRI figure based on official government reports to SIPRI. There are people, including some from the Centro de las here, who think the real figure is much higher, and I think they are probably right. But in terms of public information, we can rely on this figure. At least it's the best we have. Now, the comparison is important to make, because how much do we really need to solve the problems of poverty in the world? If we're going to compare disarmament with development, we have to have a figure for development. So IPB has been looking at the different calculations on what does it cost to reach the Millennium Development Goals, which are the 8 goals agreed by governments in the year 2000, the objectives. The World Bank says one figure, the United Nations gave a figure 8 years ago, which are a little bit less than our figures. We used only official figures from the United Nations. The problem is definitions. The objectives are very vague, so it's difficult to attribute precise numbers. Anyway, our figure, which you can see on our website, or I can send you the calculation, is $329 billion per annum, extra to the current investments in health and education and so on around the world. Okay, it's a big number, but it's only 20% of the amount we're spending on the military. And of course, the figures on the military are going up all the time. Another figure, since we're in an arms trade conference, is to compare with the total arms sales. Now, that's not spending of our money. That's money coming in to the private companies. $400 billion, mostly to their own armed forces. So that's about 25% if you want to compare it with the global spending total. But this is, as I say, income rather than expenditure. And then some people like to compare these numbers with government development aid to developing countries. And there the total from the OECD is $328 billion, about the same as the MGG's total there. But it hasn't achieved the Millennium Development Goals. So you could say, well, where is the money getting lost? And that's a long discussion. Okay, no more statistics, but these might be useful for you in making the case. Am I halfway through? A little more? Over. Okay, I speed up. So, the justifications. Because we have to think, it's not enough just to criticize and saying you're spending a lot. We have to think out why do governments continue to invest and invest more and more, even at a time of economic crisis. The usual answer you get from the Americans and many of the European governments is terrorism. Well, I think there's a bit more to it than that. They are, of course, used the military forces for humanitarian relief, but if that was their only job, we could have civilian forces to do that. Humanitarian intervention is another thing and a big controversial debate. We won't discuss Libya now, but clearly that's one of the purposes they have in mind, either through NATO or through the UN or directly. Then you have factors that are hard to assess but are important. There's a whole history to this. We have hundreds, thousands of years of military activity. There's tradition, there's support for regiments and battalions and communities of military people. In many developing countries, the idea of a military as a unifying force is very important at the national level. And of course it gives prestige, which is impossible to quantify. But politicians and maybe ordinary people sometimes think it's important. Remember when the Pakistanis tested their bomb and the people were dancing in the streets because they thought it gave them big power. Then there's the problem of the others, the people we might need the weapons against to deter them, the neighbors further away, the big powers. I'm sure North Korea thinks that it's defending its country by having a bomb. The Americans won't attack them if they have a nuclear bomb, they think. And then there are people inside, the rebels, which is a huge problem in so many parts of the South in particular. So that's a whole set of reasons that we have to argue with and struggle with in the official discourse. But maybe there are, in fact, some other reasons that would be our explanations. Maybe this is really more about domination and control, building alliances, projecting power, and power is also a gendered concept, so a lot of this comes from the male traditions of the warrior. And I think possibly the most important of all is the coming competition, which has already started. Think of the oil wars, Iraq, and so on. The competition for natural resources, which are running out. Vested interests, the power of the lobbies, not only military, but also commercial. So we are up against big forces, but I always say we mustn't be depressed by the size of the task. Let us rather be impressed by our own efforts. And I want to show you quickly some of the things that people did during the day. So here we begin with Africa. And this is, I think it's such a moving picture because it's just young school kids, all in school uniform, with this very simple handmade banner with a spelling mistake. But, you know, it's really their action. And that's the important thing. So one of the most interesting groups, really, the most thoughtful groups, was the group, the Nouveau Droit de l'Homme in Cameroon, which is a human rights group. And as you see, they had this round table and they started to launch a campaign to pressure the parliament, which is exactly the kind of political step we need to take. They wrote an interesting paper about their approach to this. In the Philippines, the photo is a bit dark, I'm afraid, sorry. They took with them, this is the famous peace boat that travels around the world, you know it. I think. They brought with them Hibakusha, the victims of Hiroshima, and they went to the office of the presidential advisor to the peace process. You know, they have this conflict with Mindanao, in Mindanao, and there's an official presidential advisor. So go to the top. And they took students and others, and they made their point there. In South Korea, they went out to the street, and I love this. We asked the people a remarkable question. Where would you spend the eye-popping money swallowed up by the global military spending? And if you write it in won, which is the South Korean currency, you get this enormous number. I mean, it's really impressive. That's a good way to make a point. I love this picture because these are village women in Rajasthan, in the western part of India, and they put International Peace Bureau right at the top. You know, it's great. And you know, they'd had these rallies and so on, and they brought two budget experts to come to the workshops and explain about this, and they got it on the local TV. So you know, if it can be done in a small village community, surely it can be done in bigger places. This was a nice picture from the US, where these multicultural picture of kids. So 1.6 trillion on education, a little bit hard to read, and then at the bottom, not military. Aha, España. Maybe the person who took this picture is in the room. I don't know. Was it Cristobal, maybe, from Andalusia? Well, anyway, there it is. Comida, no bombas. And another one. Alimentos, viviendas, dignas, educación y sanidad. So the message is clear from España. This is what we did in Geneva in front of the United Nations. We occupied this big square and we showed the difference between military spending and the Millennium Goal spending with boxes. So we had this enormous long line of boxes for the military spending and these short lines for the Millennium Goals. And if you take the photograph like we did with the United Nations behind, we think the message comes over quite well. So they did a little TV interview with me for that. Okay. This is a little bit about our thinking afterwards and our plans for next year. Well, just to keep it short, you know, next year there is a very important international conference, the Rio Plus 20 conference, 20 years since the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 92. And it will be a big focus for all the debates about poverty, about development, about climate change, about environment. But so far, nobody's even talking about peace, let alone the military spending aspect. So this is an opportunity for us. It's a big challenge, it's a huge machinery, but the dates are June the 4th to the 6th. It's only 3 days for the governmental meeting, but I'm sure that the NGO, the Civil Society Summit, will go on for a long time. There are preparatory conferences and all kinds of events around it. So I think if you haven't been thinking about Rio, now is the time to make some plans and investigate the information about this. And if you're interested to come to Rio or to do some work in your own country before Rio to improve the government's position, putting in the military spending question, then maybe get in touch with me. There's work to be done at the regional level. We had a campaign in the Pacific so that several governments would all reduce their spending, because it's hard to have one reducing if the others are not. So mutual reductions. We need to do a lot more work at the national level. We're collecting case studies now. The newsletter outside has some small case studies on different countries and how much they're cutting or not cutting the spending. We need to reach out to the other civil society sectors. I have a meeting soon with the International Trade Union Confederation, the biggest trade union in the world, who are very interested in this campaign. So I'm hopeful that they will take it up. And there's a lot to be done to develop techniques at the local level. We will announce the date as soon as we can. But probably our messages from GDAMs will be related particularly to Rio. So there you have the website and my email address if you wish to communicate more about this. We have a listserv. You can join the list and get regular information and newsletters, etc. And there are some publications. I have one or two of these books available. The first one describes the problem. The second one describes some actions and a guide for campaigners. And the third one is a specialist book about nuclear weapons and the cost of those, muchas gracias.
Okay. I will be talking about European Network Against Arms Trade, a little bit, introduce the network to you as far as you don't know it. European Network Against Arms Trade is one of the organizers of the international seminar that is now being held in Barcelona, on which Centre de Laws and Justicia Pau are also helping organizing. and participating, of course, a lot. And where about 50 people from about, I think, 20 countries are participating. And we are discussing the issue on war profiteering. And also the peace movement responses to war profiteering, because you can analyze the issue, but you must also think about your strategies to counter the issue. Our European Network Against Arms Trade was founded in the 80s. It was at the time, old history lesson, ladies and gentlemen, was at the time of the Iran-Iraq war. It was a very nasty war. And there was an arms embargo against Iran and Iraq. And at a certain point, it was discovered that there was a huge arms trade from Europe to both Iran and Iraq, and there were huge profits made. And everybody was very shocked. All big European arms producing countries were involved. For example, my country delivered about 40% of the chemicals for Saddam Hussein, with which he made his chemical weapons, with which he bombed the village of Halabja. The companies who provided these chemicals and all the other companies, the arms companies, most of them were fined, but the amount of money that they had to pay was symbolic in relation to the profits they made. On this chemical weapon thing, we have done a lot of effort to get the middleman who arranged this trade between the Netherlands and Saddam Hussein to have him in court. The government has been blocking it for a long time. There was also some secret service elements involved. It was very difficult to get him in court, but finally he has been brought to court, and he's now sentenced to 17 years of imprisonment. But unfortunately, the politician who knew that there was a production of chemical weapons in Iraq and who was blocking legislation in the Netherlands to stop it more quickly, it is very difficult to get him in court. We are still trying this after all these years. We are still doing research to get the evidence, because we know he knew that it was happening, but you have to prove it in court before you can do something. And it's a very right-wing and very nasty and very racist politician, so we very keen on getting him in court. We don't know if it will work, but we keep trying. Well, at that time, many people in the peace movements were very shocked to see that this huge illegal arms trade could take place. And they started to do more research on the arms trade, and they started to campaign on the arms trade, and it made sense to start an European network. At the time, I was a student. I was working for AMOC, which is an anti-militarist research organization. And later I founded a campaign against arms trade, because I thought, well, you can do research, but you have also to do the campaigning, because only the facts and figures will not change the situation. One of the big men in the beginning was Arcadi Oliveira, so I learned a lot from him, from his research here from Barcelona. He was then with the organization called 3CA. It was Campaña Contra Comercio de Armas, or something like that. I'm very glad he changed the name into Justicia Pau. It's much more easy for us foreigners to pronounce. Well, INAD, it's not really an organization. It's a loose network of groups. We don't have a secretariat. We don't have a formal membership. We share responsibility. Groups sometimes link up, like human rights groups link up for a certain period, or research institutions come to the meeting for some time. It's a bit of a loose, anarchistic-like organization, but that suits us very well, and it continues to function very well. We exchange research information. A typical INAD group is very grassroots. Most groups do very good research, and based on this research, they start campaigning. They start to expose the facts, bring them to the media themselves, or ask journalists to publish on it. They do lobby work in governments, and they do street actions. Like last year, we protested at the annual meeting of IATS, the big arms company. They had a shareholder meeting in Amsterdam, and all the shareholders came in with their big black cars, and we came in with bike taxis with our own shares, and we were at first not allowed in by the security guard, because they didn't believe that shareholders could come by bike taxi. But we had real shares, and we could come in, and we could make our point, because Dutch law is very interesting. when you have a share of only 15 euro, you are allowed to speak at the big shareholder meeting and address the CEOs of this huge international corporation and tell them that they should not sell weapons to dictators. So those kind of actions we are involved in, and most INAT groups are involved in those kind of actions. And I think it's a very effective combination to have this research and to also have this campaign work and lobby work together, that you have it in, well, you do it all. It's not that just research works or just lobby works or just street action works. You have to do it all to come to your results. Well, we do not really do common campaigns in INAT because we don't have a secretariat. Somebody has to organize common campaigns. We did about twice. We did one big common campaign on Amsterdam to Indonesia, but 10 years ago we had somebody from Indonesia here that was still under Suharto, the military dictator. And this person from Indonesia, he was very brave because he dared to speak up against the military. By that time you could criticize a little bit on the government, but you should not criticize the military. It was very dangerous. Some other person we worked with actually got killed because he criticized the military. But this person, he came to Europe and he had his tour all over Europe, and this was a common campaign of INAT. And we also did some common research on export credits. Export credits are when a company wants to export to a country which is political or economical a bit of a risk, then the government gives the credit that if the trade is not paid for, the government takes over the debt. And we did a common European research and we found that of all these export credits, more than one third was used to support the arms export. This was not only going to countries in Africa or Latin America or something, but also a lot to Greece. A lot of the Greece debt, Pere said it yesterday, was coming from the profits that were made by northern European countries by the arms they exported. So we do not often do this all common campaign, but normally we find out when we meet or when we discuss that we are working on the same subjects, we confronting the same kind of problems. Like now, the most groups are working on, in some way, on the investment of the military industry. So on banks that give the money to the military industry to support their trade and export and production. Another thing that we have been working on in common recently is the arms export to Arab countries. That was this spring when we found out, well, in the Netherlands we found it out by watching Al Jazeera, and we saw a movie from Bahrain, and we said, well, we see here this armed cars, and we know them because they were sold by the Netherlands, and they're now going to the demonstrators, actually. So first thing we did was check if it were really the Dutch armed cars. We had an expert in our team who said, who checked all the military handbooks. And I think it was something like the Dutch armed cars had 8 wheels and other had 6 wheels. So, and these had 8 wheels, so we were sure these were the Dutch armed cars. And then we start calling journalists and we start parliamentarians. And it ended up in big row in the parliament because these arms export to Bahrain was actually done by the Dutch state. It were second-hand Dutch armed cars. We also sold them to Egypt. And we recently sold spare parts to Egypt, so the Egyptian military can continue to use their armed cars against the protesters. Well, it turned out that in many other European countries, the same kind of problems appeared. Like in UK, there was also they also noticed UK equipment in the hands of the police confronting the people demonstrating for more democracy. And in Switzerland, I think they found out that there were Swiss small arms in the hand of the police that was confronting the demonstrators for democracy. I think the most extreme case was the IDS, the big military company, which up to 5 days before the Western troops started to bomb Libya, had an agency in Tripoli to sell arms to Libya, because there has been an arms embargo to Libya for, I think, up to 2 or 3 years, but then when it was over, immediately the arms industry started to go to Libya and try to sell the equipment. So 5 days after this salesman from this military industry left the country, or I don't know, they left the office anyway, Libya, Tripoli started to become bombed by the planes of this same company. And they were met by weapons from Gaddafi made by this same company. And even the rebels used weapons made by this same company. So if there's one profiteer of the Libyan rebellion, that is this big arms company. And if the people profit from the rebellion, it is still to be seen. So this was the... taken a lot of time for many of our groups in the beginning of this year. Now, there's another issue on which many groups are now working, which is the military relations with Israel. European countries do export not as much to Israel as the United States. I mean, Israeli import of weapons comes for 5% from the United States, which is given for free on the support act. But there still is a lot of military relations. There's also arms import, and there's also a lot of common research and development of weapons. So the European military industry is using the knowledge of the Israeli arms industry, which have developed their weapons and have sharpened their weapons and improved their weapons because they could use them. They use them against the Palestinian population, so they have experience in the field, which is very useful in the arms industry and which is now used by European arms industry to develop new European weapons. Actually, Alejandro Pozzo from Centro de Las has done excellent research on this. So, and there are many groups now in Europe working on this to see if we can stop this military relations with Israel, because we don't think that we should profit from the repression of the Palestinians by developing better weapons. So these are also kind of issues that we have been discussing at the seminar this last 2 days. And it has been really very inspiring, and I'm very happy that the people from Barcelona has given us the possibility to have this seminar here. We have a beautiful location with a very nice garden, and you provided very nice weather, so we're very happy with you. We have, for example, had a workshop on drones. Your drones, they are the unmanned systems. They're used for spying. They fly in the air. They are steered from a distance. And some of them are armed. Actually, some of them are directed from the United States, and they fly over Pakistan and they bomb Pakistan. So they're a very weird new technical thing, which is really a bestseller in the arms market. It's really very hot. You need to have these very beautiful thing. And we had very good workshops and discussions on this drone development. We discussed the technical developments, we discussed how we could campaign against them, and the inspiring thing in this international seminar is that we have people from the drones producing countries like the United Kingdom and Israel, and we had also people from the countries which are affected by these drones, like from Palestine and from Pakistan. And they were together, and they tried together to find solutions for this big problem. And I think this is a very inspiring. There's now a lot of consolidation of the European industry. There are two very big aerospace industries, which is BAE Systems, former British Aerospace, and IATS, which is also owned for 5% by the Spanish state, former Caisse in BAE Systems. There's still more national arms industry on land vehicles, on shipyards, and on aircraft engines. But this might change quickly under pressure of a shrinking European defense budgets. And you see two tendencies now. On the one hand, you have the tendency of the which is more politically initiated to have a more consolidated European defense industry, which should be the strong industry of a strong Europe, which should militarize and should be a real power bloc. And on the other hand, you have the sometimes political, but also more economically motivated idea that we should have these links between the United States and European industry. So the transatlantic merges. For that, there is a bit of a problem for the United States military industry that in Europe we have still this export control mechanism. It's not, we have a mechanism that for every military export you need a license. And this license is checked against some criteria of human rights and conflicts. And it's not a really good system, but it is a system, and it's irritating for international mergers. It's irritating for the American industry. So I think some in the American industry hope that when there will be a United Nations arms trade treaty, which is now worked on, this European system will some sort of collapse. So we have to be very careful that we keep up this European system, although it is very imperfect. We should take care that we have some license system and some control system over our arms export. I just got a note that I have only 2 minutes left, and there's one thing I really wanted to say, and Colin already mentioned it a little, and that is that we are speaking here about arms war profiteering, and this is the subject of our seminar, and this is the subject of this Trabada, yeah, I learned Catalan, no? Bad dictators, which we kicked out. And arms trade is also about keeping up cheap supply for your own armies, because to develop a new weapon system needs a lot of very expensive research. And the whole market is only small. So if you export, you have more production. And then, as we all know, the figures for one unit goes down and you cut cheaper supply for your own armies. So it's also in the interest of your own national Ministry of Defense to have a big export. And this will even be more so when the defense budget are going down under the crisis and the budget cuts. The pressure to export will be even bigger. And you see arms industries trying to develop new markets in upcoming economies in Latin America and North Africa. And we also should not forget that there's also a strategy behind it. I mean, the Western arms industry is there to make weapons for the NATO. It is the things they make are designed to provide arms for the NATO strategy, which is not to defend our home territory, which is explicitly to defend the supply of raw materials and oil, and they are made to not to be here in our countries, but to fight long-distance war in faraway countries, which might treat our oil supply. So it's not only on the profiting, it's the strategy behind the arms industry, which we should take into account if we are fighting this arms industry. So I want to thank you.
¿Aló? ¿Aló? ¿Se escucha bien? Sí. Okay. Buenas noches, buenas tardes. Gracias por estar aquí, por la invitación. Después de, creo que ya más de un año atrás, que creo que envié el primer correo electrónico a la dirección de correo electrónico general de Centro de las. ¿Qué les parece, después de una reunión que habíamos tenido con ENAT en Ámsterdam, ¿qué les parece organizar un seminario en conjunto con ENAD en Barcelona. Y después pasaron una semana, no había respuesta del correo y decía, ¿qué va a pasar aquí? Pero después, después de dos semanas, un correo de vuelta muy, muy positivo, sí, muy bienvenidos. Nosotros prestamos aquí Barcelona entera para organizar este seminario y aprovechar también de realizar al mismo tiempo la tradicional trovada, que ya primera vez que yo participo, pero que lleva muchos años, ¿no? Entonces, es muy gratificante después de ya más de un año de este primer correo estar aquí y después de ya dos días intensos de trabajo que me imagino que mucha gente está bastante cansada después de dos días de un seminario bastante lleno de contenido, entonces me disculpamos un poco a los participantes por no haber tenido ningún tiempo casi de descanso, pero bueno, y no olvidamos a veces un poco del tiempo que hay que descansar y disfrutar y parece que nos estamos dedicando mucho a la información y al trabajo, pero ojalá es que mañana tengamos un poco más de tiempo para disfrutar. Bueno, como dijeron, soy Javier y trabajo en la Internacional de Resistente a la Guerra en Londres, una red antimilitarista, no violenta, pacifista, con muchos miembros. Según a quien le pregunta uno, hay cantidad, los números de miembros, pero son como más de 80, siempre decimos, en más cerca de 40 países. Y como dijeron, mi trabajo se centra en dos áreas. Uno es el área de la promoción de la no violencia y la acción no violenta. Y la segunda área es el trabajo contra el negocio de la guerra, promocionar campañas contra el negocio de la guerra. Entonces, al pensar el trabajo fue un poco la idea de usar las herramientas que nos entrega la no violencia y también los principios, y para campañas contra la guerra, incluyendo campañas contra el negocio de la guerra. Entonces, cuando decían que publicamos un manual para campañas no violentas, la idea era que este manual fuese usado para campañas no violentas contra el negocio de la guerra. Incluso aquí hay una persona promocionando el manual, así que genial. Cecil. Entonces, bueno, esa era la idea en su origen y, bueno, el manual ha tenido su vida propia un poco y el trabajo del negocio de la guerra también su vida propia por otro lado, pero de alguna forma ahora estoy tratando de volver a juntarlo después de casi cinco años de haber trabajado los dos temas de forma separada. ¿Y esto por qué? Porque el tema de hoy es el tema de las campañas contra el negocio de la guerra, ¿no? Ayer escuchamos mucho de, bueno, quiénes son los que se benefician de la guerra, cuáles son las empresas, cuáles son los gobiernos, cuáles son los mecanismos que ellos tienen para lucrar, para beneficiarse de la guerra, ¿no? Y ahora, ¿qué hacemos, no? ¿Qué hacemos con toda esta información que también durante estos dos días hemos estado recibiendo mucha información de quiénes son estas? Hay un grupo que el seminario está dividido, tenemos tres grupos temáticos y un grupo temático que se llama los malhechores, creo que lo tradujeron al castellano, pero es los the bad guys, ¿no? Para nosotros lo importante es planear acciones que sean no solamente simplemente una rutina de acciones una tras otra o que sean pasar de una acción a otra siguiendo diferentes organizaciones que organizan acciones todo el tiempo, sino que nos parece lo importante es que detrás de estas acciones hay una campaña detrás, a más largo plazo, que haya una estrategia, que haya una visión detrás de esto, de por qué estamos haciendo estas acciones. Nos parece genial que la gente haga acciones, que vaya a la calle, que salga a la calle, eso no hay que, o sea, y que sea espontánea y creativa, pero al mismo tiempo que piense un poco, o sea, ¿por qué estamos haciendo esta acción? ¿Qué es lo que está detrás de esta acción? Entonces, un poco algunas lineamientos de cómo se puede, qué puede ayudar para desarrollar estas campañas que sean más estratégicas, que tengan mayor impacto y que nuestras acciones tengan mayor impacto, ¿no? Entonces, para tener una acción, una campaña, lo primero es tener muy claro cuál es el problema, ¿no? ¿A qué es lo que estamos, nuestra campaña, qué es lo que se está enfocando, ¿no? Entonces hay que tener muy claro cuál es este problema que estamos enfocándonos en nuestra campaña y ser capaces de escribirlo claramente. Entonces, que tú, si tú vas, tienes un amigo, tienes un vecino y tú puedes decirle en una palabra muy simple, este es el problema que yo tengo, sin tener que complicarse con muchas palabras, sino que sea un mensaje directo, sencillo, simple, que uno pueda transmitir, ¿no? Entonces, si no tienes esa claridad de escribir el problema de una forma clara, es muy difícil después saber cómo seguir, ¿no? Si no tienes la claridad de cuál es ese problema. Después un poco entonces, ya sabiendo cuál es ese problema, entonces un poco el por qué existe este problema, ¿no? Hay que analizar cuáles son los motivos de este problema. Entonces, ver quién es el que tiene el poder detrás de esto, ¿no? Porque siempre hay alguien que está manejando y que tiene, vemos, como vimos ayer, los que tienen el poder, los que están beneficiándose del negocio de la guerra en esta ocasión, en este tema, ¿no? Y quién es, entonces, y al mismo tiempo de quiénes tienen el poder, pero también quiénes contamos, y aquí muchos de nosotros, quiénes tenemos poder para cambiar esta situación, ¿no? Porque hay diferentes poderes, ¿no? Entonces también nosotros tenemos nuestro propio poder, que podemos intervenir, tenemos capacidad de cambiar cosas, tenemos que por lo menos creer eso. Si no creemos que podemos cambiar las cosas, partimos ya mejor para qué. Y después entonces ver un poco cuál, al analizar eso, bueno, cuáles son las debilidades, las fortalezas, todos estos métodos de análisis que tenemos para analizar quién tiene el poder y dónde mejor poder dirigir nuestras acciones, ¿no? Después de tener eso, lo importante también es tener una visión, ¿no? ¿A dónde queremos llegar con nuestra campaña? ¿Qué es lo que una visión a veces así llama utópica o a largo plazo, ¿no? ¿Cuál es a dónde queremos llegar con nuestra campaña? Y al mismo tiempo, metas que sean realistas a corto plazo, que sean realizables. Si tú tienes, entonces eso te puede ayudar en tu trabajo de tener metas que tú puedas ir avanzando, ¿no? Y así tener un poco claro hacia dónde vamos, ¿no? Y poder siempre estar revisando estas metas, ¿no? Que estamos cumpliéndolas, nos está llevando por el buen camino o no. Y bueno, después de ahí uno empieza ya a trabajar más el tema de la estrategia, un plan de acción, cuáles son las acciones que pueden componer esta campaña para trabajar para formar la campaña, para darle fuerza a esta campaña. Y bueno, y hay que encontrar que sean tácticas, acciones que sean adecuadas con los objetivos de la campaña, ¿no? Entonces que el grupo en el cual tú formas esté dispuesto a realizar tal acción, si tú quieres. O sea, de tener una fábrica de armas, pero no hay, y una gente dice, bueno, entremos a destruir la base militar, pero nadie siquiera está dispuesto a saltar una valla. Entonces, bueno, esa no es la acción que corresponde, ¿no? Entonces que las acciones tengan relación con la capacidad que tenemos como grupo y también que tenga una capacidad de impactar en este caso empresa o lo que queramos trabajar, ¿no? Y bueno. Y así, ir de a poco, ir al tiempo que uno va desarrollando estas estrategias, siempre estar evaluando y tener la capacidad siempre de evaluar lo que está sucediendo con nuestras campañas y hacia dónde nos está llevando. Y lo más importante siempre, tener un mensaje simple, claro, que se entienda, y muy importante, bueno, usar imágenes que sean llamativas, que sean y provocativas al mismo tiempo, y usar especialmente también temas, en el tema del comercio y del negocio del arma, es muy importante muchas veces usar temas que son bien controversiales, ¿no? Cuando, por ejemplo, en el caso ahora de la primavera árabe, ¿no? Y la venta de armas a Libia u otros países, ¿no? Entonces, son temas que se pueden usar muy de una forma bastante sencilla de exponer las contradicciones que existen detrás de este negocio, ¿no? Entonces hay que encontrar estas contradicciones que nos ayudan y nos permiten abrir puertas para nuestras campañas, encontrar cuáles son ese espacio, ¿no? Que hay para donde uno puede incidir en nuestras campañas. Según el teórico de la no violencia, Gene Sharp, dice él que tiene un listado gigante de estas 198 forma de acción no violenta, ¿no? Y tiene ahí, las clasifica, bueno, en tres principales categorías, ¿no? Una es protesta y persuasión, la segunda es no cooperación y la tercera es no, intervención, ¿no? Entonces, una protesta o una persuasión puede ser, por ejemplo, una marcha, ¿no? Que es tiene una gran capacidad de convocar a mucha gente, ¿no? Entonces, por ejemplo, me gustaría ahora preguntar, que levanten la mano aquí, ¿quién ha participado en una marcha alguna vez en su vida? Me imagino que, bueno, ¿ves? ¿Todos? Entonces, claro. Entonces, eso tiene un poder de convocar a mucha gente, ¿no? Es muy tiene la capacidad de unir, de convocar y de mostrar también que somos muchos, ¿no? Que estamos en contra, por ejemplo, del negocio de la guerra. Tiene ese poder, ¿no? Es demostrar que somos muchos, que tenemos número detrás, ¿no? Pero al mismo tiempo, muchas veces hay una marcha tras otra, ya semana tras semana, ya los gobiernos, los estados, están acostumbrados a las marchas, ¿no? Y tienen una gran capacidad para obviarlas, ¿no? A no ser que la marcha tenga algún componente creativo diferente que tome riesgo, bueno, y principalmente también en países, por ejemplo, donde marchas son ilegales, ¿no? Eso, ahí sí, bueno, tiene un gran poder de pasar a ser ya un acto de desobediencia civil, ¿no? También dentro de esta categoría podemos hablar de firmar cartas, ¿no? De petición, hacer listado, ¿no? ¿Cuánta gente no ha firmado en la calle caminando y que Amnistía tiene un listado de petición, ¿no? Yo me imagino que si hago la pregunta todos levantarían de nuevo la mano, ¿no? Entonces y tiene esa capacidad también, ¿no? De incluir mucha gente, ¿no? Pero tiene también sus limitantes, ¿no? O sea, llega hasta cierto punto, los gobiernos están bastante acostumbrados a recibir sus cartas, que la archivan la ponen en otro archivo, en un armario, y bueno, ahí queda la carta, que es importante hacerla, pero llega hasta cierto punto, ¿no? Entonces, y bueno, y dentro de nuestra red, ¿no? Nuestra red, yo hablo en un sentido amplio, a mí me gusta ser inclusivo. Yo en nuestra red estoy hablando ahora de la IRG, pero también estoy hablando un poco de ENAT, ¿no? Y no me refiero solamente a miembros de la IRG, sino que en nuestra red contra el negocio de las armas. Y en esta red, entonces, por ejemplo, ahora en el caso de Libia, la campaña contra el comercio de armas en Inglaterra, en el Reino Unido, CAT realizó una... creó una campaña llamada Esto no es correcto, This is not okay, ¿no? Y una campaña denunciando la conexión del Reino Unido y la venta a armas a regímenes no democráticos. Y bueno, y en esta campaña ellos, si tú vas a la página de CAT, en la página web, que es CAT, estoy haciendo aquí propaganda, publicidad para cat.org.uk, tú vas y tienen una petición online, muy fácil, muy sencilla, para mandar un mensaje a un miembro del Parlamento en el Reino Unido diciendo esto no está correcto, ¿no? Y estas son herramientas muy útiles y ahora con la tecnología permite que con gran cantidad de número uno pueda bombardear casi con mensajes diciendo que esto no está correcto, ¿no? Y son... métodos que podemos usar que tienen mucha efectividad, ¿no? Pero también los gobiernos pueden están acostumbrados un poco y proyectos hay que buscar siempre cómo esto se puede llegar a ser creativo, ser más, buscar los espacios más controversiales, ¿no? También usando un poco también el caso de ahora de lo que ha sucedido en los países árabes. Y esto del tema de las contradicciones, ¿no? De muchos de estos gobiernos. Estas contradicciones son muy buenas para ocupar nuestro repertorio de humor, ¿no? Tenemos mucha capacidad de usar de hacer acciones que sean humorísticas, ¿no? Que muestren nuestra contradicción, pero de una forma visible, muy clara, pero que tampoco sea faltando el respeto, pero que use el humor, que muchas veces transmite mucho más con mucha más facilidad, llega a la gente con mucha más facilidad si tú tienes una acción que te sorprende, ¿no? Y estas son oportunidades que nos permite para pensar en acciones que sean usando el humor, que sean creativas, este tipo de contradicciones que nos permite que nos, por ejemplo, que ahora con lo que ha sucedido en los países árabes. Entonces me parece siempre importante el incluir ese componente cuando pensamos en nuestras acciones contra la guerra, ¿no? Y podría estar aquí nombrando muchas diferentes formas de petición o de carta o de acciones que han hecho, pero una también que me gustaría y que un poco diferente. Yo pensaba que iba a hablar rapidito, pero me parece que no tanto. Es el caso de aquí de nuestros amigos de Suiza, ¿no? Que tienen una situación muy especial en su país, que si juntan, si mal me equivoco, 100.000 firmas, pueden llamar a un referéndum, ¿no? Son 100.000. Sí. Entonces pueden llamar a un referéndum y el grupo aquí, Suiza sin ejército, bueno, no se cansa en juntar firmas, me parece que día tras día están juntando firmas y, bueno, hace un par de años llamaron a un referéndum para abolir la exportación de armas de Suiza, ¿no? Que Suiza deje de exportar armas. Perdieron el referéndum, mala suerte, pero fue una campaña que logró unir mucha gente, muchas diferentes organizaciones y que logró poner el tema de la exportación de armas suiza en el medio ahí en Suecia, ¿no? Suiza. Y entonces son herramientas y posibilidades que dependen en cada país, cuáles son las posibilidades que nosotros tenemos para hacer acciones. Y por ejemplo, entonces el caso de Suiza, un caso particular, pero muy interesante lo que ellos han realizado. La segunda categoría que había mencionado, que ya me imagino se olvidaron, era, hablé de no cooperación, ¿no? Y siempre, me parece muchas veces que en el trabajo contra el negocio de la guerra estamos casi con una obsesión de buscar qué podemos boicotear, ¿no? El boicot a veces se transforma siempre en encontrar un producto, una empresa que podemos hacer un boicot, que es una herramienta muy poderosa, pero hay que también saber cuáles son. No todo se puede boicotear, ¿no? Hay, por ejemplo, si tú quieres hacer un boicot a Lockheed Martin, la empresa más grande de Estados Unidos, yo no compro un F-16 o un F-17. Difícil para mí boicotear el Lockheed Martin, ¿no? Entonces hay que saber cuáles son las empresas que uno sí puede boicotear, que otras no. Por ejemplo, hoy día hubo un taller sobre mercenarios, ¿no? Las nuevas empresas, las empresas privadas con soldados. Eso también muy difícil de boicotear. Uno ni siquiera su oficina muchas veces no se sabe dónde son, no se sabe cómo reclutan muchas veces a su soldado y tiene una conexión directa con los gobiernos, ese es su cliente, ¿no? Entonces muy difícil hacer boicot. Pero al mismo tiempo sí hay otras opciones muy muy claras de hacer para hacer boicot, ¿no? Y por ejemplo me gustaría aquí también nuevamente hacer la pregunta: ¿cuántas personas cuando van o salen de compras o van al supermercado se miran en el supermercado si el producto es de Israel o no es de Israel? Me gustaría que levanten la mano quién se fija si el producto es de Israel al momento de hacer una compra. Bueno, algunos. Entonces, esa es una herramienta que se usa. Bueno, y aquí este fin de semana hemos contado con la presencia de Inés, que está por ahí atrás, que es de Israel y de un grupo que se llama Who Profits, que en Israel, y que se dedica a denunciar cuáles son las empresas que están beneficiándose de la ocupación de Palestina, ¿no? Y tienen, si ustedes se meten a su página web, que es whoprofits.org, encontrarán un listado de las empresas que están israelitas que se benefician de la ocupación en Palestina. Muy un recurso que les recomiendo mucho, que una página web que vayan y revisen, ¿no? Y ahí uno puede ver también de dónde vienen los productos que uno después recibe en el supermercado, en nuestros propios países. Y el otra forma de y que es no cooperación o y que es bastante bueno muy cercana a lo que es el trabajo de la IRG es el tema de los impuestos de la impuesto a la guerra, ¿no? Impuestos de la guerra. Tengo que cortarme. Bueno, entonces el tema de mucha gente acá sabrá el tema de la objeción fiscal, ¿no? Y el valor que tiene eso de cómo una acción personal, pero al mismo tiempo colectiva, el poder que tiene eso de yo decidir, mi impuesto no van a ser usado, un porcentaje de los impuestos que yo pago no van a ir al Ministerio de Defensa, no van a ir a lo militar, ¿no? Es un acto bien, que en principio es personal, pero también se transforma en un acto social, ¿no? Y si incluso más, si es que apoyas el movimiento aquí en el Estado español de objeción fiscal, muchas veces se redirige dinero a proyectos de paz que incluso mejor, ¿no? Entonces, si hay alguien de ustedes no hace objeción fiscal o no hace objeción fiscal, yo iba nuevamente a pedir levantar la mano, pero ya estamos muy corto de tiempo, pero sí, si tienen, ahí pregunten al vecino si ustedes hacen objeción fiscal o no, y si no la hacen, bueno, averigüen y por favor empiecen a hacerla. Me voy a saltar bastante de lo que tenía y pasar a lo último, que es lo que teníamos como acciones de intervención y que son, que, bueno, acciones directas de bloqueo, de acciones que son así, a veces con niveles de riesgo más altos, que no todos podemos hacerlo. Entonces, lo importante es poder combinar estas tres diferentes niveles, ¿no? Que hay gente que puede, se suma a las marchas, hace peticiones, hay otra gente que está dispuesta, tal vez, a entrar a una fábrica militar y hacer un desarme. Y desarmar una fábrica donde haya misiles o algo así. Y en este caso sí me gustaría hacer que levanten la mano, pero me gustaría preguntar quién en esta sala ha entrado a una fábrica militar para desarmar un misil. Y si no me está escuchando, voy a tener que llamarla por nombre. ¡Ay, dos! ¡Bien! Entonces, aquí tenemos a Alexander y Alvin.
¿Tienes medallas?
Han entrado a fábricas militares y para desarmar. Yo he visto, hay un video en YouTube con Alvin dentro de una fábrica con un martillo rompiendo un misil. Así, entonces, bueno, o tratando por lo menos de... Entonces, estas acciones no todo el mundo las puede hacer, pero si hay gente que está dispuesta, como Alvin y Alexander, bienvenido, y son acciones que lo que tienen son muy llamativas, tienen una capacidad muy de eso, de crear como hacer un llamado, ¿no? Y crear una, esto es sorprendente y llama mucho la atención. Entonces tienen ese poder y al mismo tiempo tienen el otro componente que muchas veces al hacer esta acción van presos, ¿no? Es muy, que bueno. Y muchas veces cuando van presos significa que también se puede hacer una campaña de hacer un juicio, llevar incluso a juicio a esta fábrica que produce armamento. Me estoy excediendo mucho de tiempo, pero hay varios casos de personas que han hecho acciones entrando y destruyendo armas y al final han ganado su juicio diciendo que han prevenido un crimen mayor, ¿no? Y han logrado ganar su juicio, lo cual es genial, ¿no? Tú desarmas un arma, te llevan preso, pero al final ganas tu juicio. Ya han habido varios casos en Inglaterra, últimamente ahora con una organización, un grupo que se llama Smash Ido, que hizo unas acciones durante los ataques a Gaza de Israel y ganaron su juicio hace poco, ¿no? Entonces son acciones muy llamativas. Bueno, ya como estoy realmente pasado de tiempo, decir eso, ¿no? De que nos tenemos que preparar para nuestras acciones, tenemos que saber lo que hacemos, pero al mismo tiempo tenemos que saber poder divertirnos, ¿no? Encontrar acciones que sean creativas, que sean novedosas y poder pasarla bien también, ¿no? Y disculpa a la gente que ha participado al seminario porque no hemos dedicado más a la parte de preparar, trabajar y el pasarlo bien lo hemos dejado un poco de lado, así que ojalá que tengamos tiempo para recuperar esa parte del divertirnos y pasarlo bien. Muchas gracias.